Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 59, recorded on March 9th of 2019. It's a fun one because I know we're going to have a lot of opinions going back and forth on this one about the geeky tech news, some weird oddities in the industry. And a man whose opinions I value quite a bit, especially for being quite frank about things, is Alan Attridge, who is the guest host this week. Alan, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm kind of a little bit under the weather, and both literally and figuratively. You know, I'm still doing the crazy snowflake thing, and yeah, the mornings and nights have been good for freezing soap bubble stuff. Haven't been shooting stills of that. I've been shooting some video and some really high quality stuff too, using an external recorder so that it'll potentially be used in some documentary films. I know some of it already will be, and I've just been gathering additional B-roll stuff for the things that I know. Those companies usually ring me up at random and say, hey, you know, Don, it's July, but do you have any footage of freezing things? And I'm like, all right, yeah, I've got some stuff that hasn't been licensed before. You can have that. But how about yourself?
I literally just got back from 7 days of snowboarding in the Alps.
And do you bring a camera with you?
I will not next time. I did. I covered every base. I thought, you know, it's my the first time my kids have ever been skiing. Really, we tried once, sort of on like a local sort of toboggan hill, and they seemed to like it. My kids are 5 and 7, and so we figured, okay, we're going on the first real family ski trip in the German Alps. I better bring. Well, I'm bringing my Fuji X100 because that's just my favorite camera. But I'm not going to bring that on the slopes with me because I like it too much. And I have my disposable 40D, which will not die. And so I tend to bring that wherever I feel like, because I don't care what happens to it.
If it just, gets buried in an avalanche or something, you know, somebody skis or snowboards over top of it, and it, you know, takes its last picture, you're fine with that.
I would like to fish the memory card out of it. Other than that, I don't care.
And cool. So, I've got some disposable cameras, too. Actually, I bought a, for $30, the original Canon Digital Rebel for an article that I wrote a couple of years ago, you know, how you can use that equipment. It's not a barrier to the success so long as you're a good photographer. And I've been just trying to figure out a way for me to destroy it by taking mm-hmm. one final photograph, because otherwise it's entirely useless for me. I just haven't found a good enough idea as how to destroy the camera taking its final picture.
Well, yeah. This one won't die. The 40D will not die. I take it everywhere. I talk about it all the time. I highly recommend picking one up. If you can, you can get one for probably 30 bucks, like you said. I ended up taking it up on the hill only one day out of the 7, just because I didn't feel like snowboarding with it. But I needed to get one photo that I wanted to use, you know, for the Christmas present next year for Oma and Opa. And so I did. I snapped that, put the camera down at the bottom of the hill, hung it on the fence, and just left it there. And no one touched it.
Did you at least take the SD card out in case somebody walked away with it?
I did. Actually, it's a CF card. But yes, I put that in my pocket. I would have been more upset if the battery had been stolen, because I can use that in my 5D Classic, which I also have. So I took that, but I barely use it. Won't take that again. I think I took two photos with the X100. Won't take that again. Took most of our photos with smartphones.
Yep. And I mean, that's the way it's going for this type of stuff. It's going to be in your pocket. It's not going to be something you have to, rest on a post somewhere or be very diligent about how you're holding and taking care of it. It's just always with you. And, yep. I'm sure you could get like a premium compact camera. The Sony, what's the RX100 series is nice mm-hmm. and small and what have you. But I mean, for what it's worth, for what these images are, a cell phone snap is good enough for you. So, I mean, why bother going further?
It goes beyond good enough. In the right light, like I was shocked, because I'm kind of snobby about the smartphone photography. I know it has its place, but it is really crossing over. I have an older iPhone, the SE, which has a very good camera in it, but it's not you're not going to be on the cover of Life magazine with that. But my wife,
I was using the iPhone 6S for years. until I upgraded to the red hydrogen phone, which I'm quite liking still. But I was still routinely taking behind the scenes photos of like my camera setups and what have you. And it was more than capable of just documenting the arrangement of different photographic equipment pieces. And I didn't need anything that was higher megapixel or better dynamic range, et cetera, et cetera. Because it was limited in what you could do. It wouldn't be an art device on its own, but...
My wife has a Samsung something or other. Maybe it ends in a 7. I don't know. I don't pay attention to these things. It was given to her at work, and the video quality on this is outstanding. And so we shot a lot of video. Like, I would snowboard and do some tracking shots. It's remarkably smooth. I don't know if there's any smoothing, any built-in stabilization. I can't imagine there is. It looks fantastic.
There's software stabilization. And of course, some cell phones do have optical stabilization as well. I know that the larger iPhones have had that for quite some time. But the means to the end doesn't matter, right? I mean, no matter which way you're doing it, so long as you're getting great results in a small package, for the end consumer that's just going to take it out and use it without wanting any barrier to entry, then, you know, it's a win, right?
Indeed. So next year we'll pack much, much lighter and stick with just the smartphones.
Perfect. Well, speaking of travel and that type of stuff, that leads us into our first story, or at least the title of it, from F-Stoppers. The title is "Just Released the Leica Q2, a 47.3 megapixel full frame compact camera and maybe my next travel camera?" But this is basically just an announcement post with some opinions on the new Leica Q2, the successor to the Leica Q, obviously. Which is kind of in the same realm as, there are a lot of, I'm not sure if every manufacturer has one, but a full-frame sensor, compact, non-interchangeable lens camera that is designed to be as small as possible with the best image quality that you can get. And Leica is no stranger to making luxury items. But this one actually strikes me as more than just a novelty. The specs really pan out for this one. Why don't you go through what might have stood out to you, Alan?
Right out of the gate, well, it looks awesome. I mean, it's Leica, right? So that red dot is fantastic.
It does look awesome in terms of minimalist approach. I mean, it does look like a classic M-series rangefinder. But I just never looked at this design and says, yeah, that'll hold nicely in my hands. It just doesn't feel right. Like it would be comfortable over a long period of time.
Oh, that is true. For me, what stood out on top of that was the full-frame sensor.
Yeah,
that is...
No, go continue.
Well, that to me is what I own the Fuji X100F, and that to me is what is quote unquote missing. Not really sure I miss it. I think I might think that I miss it, but I like shooting in quote unquote full frame, which is in German is actually called Kleinbild, which is small frame anyways compared to medium format, etc. So it's kind of, I guess, the different perspective now that we're in the digital realm. But I enjoy shooting on the full frame with my Canon multiple 5Ds. I would like the Fuji to have that. The fact that the Leica has that is a big plus.
Yeah, and it looks like it's the same sensor that is going in the Panasonic S1R. I mean, I've got no confirmation of that, but I know that Leica and Panasonic Panasonic has built some Leica branded cameras, although this one states specifically it's made in Germany, so maybe that's not the case overall. But it's the same physical dimensions and the same number of pixels down to the final digit there. So I can't imagine two brand new 47 megapixel full frame cameras sensors being manufactured. So if that does have that same sensor in it, then that's going to be a huge asset to a camera like this. And it has the same 3.68 million dot resolution electronic viewfinder that the S1 and S1R have as well. And I've looked through that viewfinder myself. I had the S1 in hand for a little while, and it is just gorgeous to use. And I'll be getting an S1R pre-production model this coming week to do some tests on a sensor just like this. And I'm assuming that it's going to be fantastic from all of the words that I've been hearing from other people. So the guts of this in terms of the viewfinder and the sensor and all of that stuff is going to be cutting edge. Now, the price is interesting because it's just shy of $5,000 US, which, you know, if you look at what goes into sort of the, I guess the correct comparison would be the S1R, you know, without a lens, you're going to be between $3,000 and $4,000 US. I don't know the exact price off the top of my head. And so you're paying for the Leica luxury, but you're also getting a lens and a full camera out of that. So I think in terms of value, this is about the only time that I think I've ever said it. It's not drastically overpriced. I think that they could easily, you know, shave maybe $700, $1,000 off of it to be in the same realm of other people, you know, in terms of value for your dollar. But that extra, you know, push to the dollar value is where the Leica brand comes in, and you're always going to have to pay for that to some degree.
I heard a quote from a rich guy one time. Now, I'm not that guy, but he basically said that he has never been disappointed by owning the best.
Well, sure. I mean, it's a nice pat on your back, and it's a, you know, if you've got an ego that's worthy of that, then that's fine. But you don't always need the best. In fact, in some cases, the most expensive is not the best, right? Are you going to be traveling around with a 150 megapixel phase one, you know, medium format camera? No, it's not the best tool for the job. Mm-hmm. Are you going to be shooting video on a high-end Canon like C700 video camera? Well, you do a lot of video work, but you don't need that. It's technically the best.
Right.
But it's not necessarily required. And because you've got the same guts in a less expensive camera body that would potentially be more capable in many different ways, then you are paying for the brand. And, you know, you are paying for that red dot. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's what it's worth to you.
What I do like about this is the idea of the fixed lens. The fixed non-zoom lens is, in my opinion, like it has made me... It hasn't made me do anything, really, but I do appreciate it. I very much like things that are extremely good at one thing without trying to be all things to all people.
Right. Jack of all trades, master of none kind of idea. So we've got the Sumilux 28mm f1.7 lens that's permanently fixed to this camera. Now, what's interesting about this, too, is I believe it has a leaf shutter in it, which is easier to do on a camera where you can't change lenses because the shutter is inside the lens itself, and it increases the manufacturing cost there. Alan, what is a leaf shutter?
Boy, it's like an aperture. It basically opens like one of those aperture doors from the movies that set in the future.
Yeah, it's like your shutter is a second aperture sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so, except when it's completely closed, it lets no light through, and then it just opens up sort of radially from the middle and then closes down again. And the value of that, specifically when you have a smaller aperture, that it doesn't have to cover the entire sensor. It just has to cover the opening of that aperture. And that means you can get much, much faster shutter speeds and sync speeds with flash specifically than you would be able to with a traditional shutter mechanism in front of the sensor itself. So there are some advantages of that. And it can remove rolling shutter effects if you have fast-moving objects across the frame and you get like a vertical line ends up being on a slight angle because of the way the shutter effect was rolling across the sensor. So yeah, there are some advantages to that, and you have that with that leaf shutter, and so that just kind of makes it a very attractive package for me.
It does for me as well, and my Fuji has the leaf shutter, which I use extensively with high speed synced flash. I don't want to say high speed sync because that's another gimmick, but at very, very fast shutter speeds and just regular low-powered flash, it is amazing what you can do with that. The one downside here is that the 28 mils struck me as rather wide for its only focal length.
Well, yeah. So you've got 47 megapixels. You can crop in if you want.
Can you? Is it the same?
No. Well, it's not the same experience, right? And people that buy Leica cameras are always about the experience. So I think that it's, you know, if they looked at the number of lenses that they were selling, and they said, okay, well, we're selling a lot of the 28mm Sumilux lenses, so let's roll that into this package. I'm sure they would have done some market research to figure out what was not only being purchased, but what was being used and what the use case for this is. If it's being targeted as a travel camera, I think wider is a little bit better. You're going to be doing street photography, potentially landscapes, although there's an argument for telephoto landscape work too. But this camera, I think, is purpose-built for that travel photographer that wants to be highest quality, light, but I don't know. I wouldn't be traveling with a big red dot on my camera. That's just that is a red flag for thieves to come and take that off your hands.
I would felt pen that over that, honestly. I would be, you know, the extra $1,000 you're spending for that, I would rather have it be gone.
And they made the Leica QP, I believe, that was a stealth version of the original Leica Leica Q. So if that's the case that they've done it in the past, I'd wait for that version of it and have all of the luxury without any of the worry, I suppose.
My verdict, I think, as great as this looks, for the value, I would stick with the X100 series, probably get a used T or get an F. I happen to love that. It is a smaller sensor, a equivalent 35mm lens, but for that much, much lower price, you're not going to be as worried out in the wild with it. And it's been my experience that most people who don't know any better think it's a beat-up old camera that you found at your grandpa's house.
Fair enough, yes. Like that felt pen over the Leica symbol, you don't want the camera to look attractive. Now, I traveled last year with the GX9 from Panasonic and loved it. It didn't let me down at all. And if a new version of that comes out, I'll probably get that one too and stick with that as my travel gear. But again, this is the first time that a Leica camera has ever really truly been appealing to me. So I figured I'd mention that to anybody looking for a new, very high quality camera that is outside the budget of some, but still inside for others. So
I feel like if I was one of those people, the dual income, no kids people, I think I'd be in for this.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a market for that for sure. Now, I'm not sure there's a market for the next story, and this came out of left field for me. Canon, this is via Petapixel. Canon unveils Rays, an AI powered photo sharing service. Okay, why?
I mean, why is it called Rays?
I think because the word Rays contains the letters A and I.
Mm-hmm. So does fail.
Yes. I love that. I might change the name of the episode. But this is... it's really confusing to me. Alan, I'm sure you read through the article and you've checked out what Canon is doing here. What possible purpose do you think this serves?
Oh, if I can be harsh, it's catering to lazy people, who is pretty much everybody now. I think... Not pointing any fingers, like, this is most of my friends who have, they all have digital cameras of some sort, be it iPhones or DSLRs or whatever. They have a strict policy of never organizing their photos, ever.
Yeah, well, so maybe you can consider me lazy in a sense there as well. However, when I was shooting Canon for many years with the 1DX and the 1DX Mark II, I actually tried to do it with the 5D Mark II to GPS geotag my images, although it was much harder back then. If I can geotag the photos, then I can categorize them based on where I took them without having to do anything in Lightroom.
But what does that matter? What does that matter where you took them? To you, what does it matter?
Well, if I want to find photos that I might have not edited from the Yukon, for example, and I've gone there twice.
When were you in the Yukon, Don? Years. What years? I don't care what month. What years?
I don't remember.
Oh, that's not the answer I was hoping for.
Well, no, one of them was 2014, and then 2012. 2012 and 2014.
Okay, so you do know. It took you a second, but you do know.
Yes, but what if it was something a little bit less obvious?
When were you in Bulgaria?
I've been there like six times.
When was the last time you were there?
Last year.
First time. When was the first time? What year?
2009.
See, this is what I'm talking about. You do know. You didn't let some piece of AI make you stupider.
This is true. This is true. So basically what this is it will categorize your image based on the content. So it will use, deep learning, artificial intelligence, whatever word you want to use, to figure out if there's people in the photo, maybe exactly what people they are, if they are a bride or a groom, you know, to detect if this is a wedding, if you're a wedding photographer. Or identify maybe if you're a food photographer or other things. So it will be specific to identifying and categorizing and correlating your images and subject matter where you won't have to do it. And it's a photo sharing service, kind of like Flickr, but there's absolutely no commenting or interaction in any way, which itself seems kind of weird. Why would you throw all of your images up for the world to see and then not have any interaction from the world at the end of it? So that was a bit odd for me too. But the best part of this article is when people started to pick apart the terms and conditions in the comments section. Did you read the comments?
I did not read the comments.
Okay. So CP, who did a lot of this stuff, I don't know what his name is, but CP, thank you so much for bringing that to my attention, because there is gold in those terms and conditions. So, first of all, one of the things is you agree not to use the platform to intentionally or unintentionally violate any applicable local, state, or national or international law. Okay.
That's good policy in general, though.
Good policy in general, but I mean, how do I know if I'm unintentionally violating an international law?
Do not taunt Happy Fun Ball. That's what it should say. That's a deep cut for some older people.
Yeah. Okay, see, this one's great. So, images of residents from Illinois, Texas, or Washington are not permitted on the platform and may be taken down.
Now, is that born there or currently reside there or have ever resided there?
It does not specify. It says images of residents, so I'm guessing current residents.
Sure.
But if you're a photographer in Texas, you can still use the service, so long as you don't upload photos of any other Texans, including yourself.
Well, it's a common known fact. I'm not spoiling anything here. Everybody knows that the people in Illinois are just not good looking.
That's your opinion, Washington. Not mine.
No, that's a fact, Don. And I guess Canon seems to know that. Although Texas and Washington, very handsome individuals. So I don't know where they're going with this.
All right. So one final bit here that was fun: prohibited conduct. CP's put some stuff in bold here, which I just love. You agree not to use the platform to upload, and I'm skipping the non-bolded stuff, or otherwise make available any content that any individual has at any time requested that you either remove from the platform or refrain from uploading, posting, transmitting, or otherwise making available for viewing.
Right.
And the sub-comment on that, this would be just the joy of this entire platform. Somebody says, if this dumb service will include a comment feature, it would be worth writing a bot that comments randomly. I request that you remove this.
Okay, we're through the looking glass, though.
Okay, yes, we are through the looking glass. But this entire service just seems just... maybe they're making a proof of concept so that they can say that they're actually using patents that they own for some particular purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems to me that this entire platform serves absolutely no purpose until you read, and I found this in the terms of service myself, point number 6, annotation data. So the entire section 6 is basically one sentence that reads, you should be aware that when you upload, post, or transmit content to the platform, annotation data, which in parentheses is defined as information pertaining to attributes of content or someone depicted in content, such as facial features or geographical information, may also be collected. So they're mining our data. That this is a data mining operation here through and through. They're
right.
Just collecting, using their AI algorithm to collect hordes of data about the content that is uploaded. Who knows what they'll use it for, but they have every right to do that, and that seems to me like the only purpose of this platform.
So this is already being done on Instagram, is it not? Behind the
scenes?
Oh,
I'm sure every platform is doing it.
Because here's what happens on when I log into Instagram or click on or just go to Instagram or however I do it. I'm not that smart when it comes to these things. if I go through, if I use a certain browser, now if I use Safari, it doesn't happen. I forget, maybe if it's Firefox, before any photo actually appears in the browser, for a split second, a description of that photo in text comes up. For example, it says image may contain mountains, ocean, sun. So it's already doing an AI sorting, and then the image comes up, and sure enough, it does contain mountains, ocean, sun, or whatever it says. So I'm pretty sure Instagram's doing this.
Well, and 500px has been doing experimenting with auto-populating the tag section when you're uploading an image there, too. I'm certain everybody's doing this to some degree. But I don't think that it's their primary purpose. And in this case from Canon, because it's a proprietary manufacturer that's launching a photo sharing platform, number one, they're never going to get industry adoption. I mean, maybe some Canon users are going to jump in here, but how many Nikon or Sony or Lumix or Pentax users are going to go in and start using a Canon-owned and operated photo sharing platform? It's unlikely at best. So this is going to fizzle away after some period of time once it's served its purpose. And I think that number six, annotation data, is the closest thing to a purpose that I can find here.
And in terms of privacy, I know privacy is the big concern always, even though it isn't, because the privacy ship has sailed. It's gone now.
Yeah. You're on the internet. You're no longer private.
It's not even you. I mean, like you, I consider you an outlier in many of these technology things. And so I'm guessing, I'm not encouraging anybody to do this, but I'm guessing getting information on you, private information, is going to be somewhat difficult. However,
you can go onto like my Facebook page or my website and find my personal phone number. I mean, that's public. You won't find my home address, though.
Okay. I'm not going to, but what I have a couple of friends who have really cool jobs in the government, not our government, in the American one. Okay. And I always kind of wondered, you know, it was like, how do you maintain privacy? And so just sort of as a proof of concept, and because I'm a curious guy, nothing nefarious, I decided to just kind of figure out what I could find out about them based on who they were friends with on Facebook. Now, they had privacy settings, but you could see certain little snippets and then find out who those people were friends with. And all of a sudden, it's like this human Sudoku where you start filling in these little bits and who was friends with whom. I think I used that right. And who shows up in a photo with so-and-so, and you don't even have to be good at this, which I'm not, to start putting together the puzzle about where people live, where they go. And so it's kind of like the herd vaccination mentality. Once a few people are anti-vaxxers, it puts the whole population at risk. And so if everybody's not being private, you're not being private.
Well, and there was the story of, this was a few years ago, I think, but a woman who was pregnant, still living at home, she was targeted by like pregnancy, a newborn baby, physical ads in her mailbox. She hadn't told her parents yet, but she was targeted. They knew that she was pregnant because of her internet search results. And so, privacy, that ship has sailed. But if you have, say, if you're a food photographer and you start taking pictures of food, well, maybe you start getting ads for cutlery and high-end kitchen utensils, you know, starting to show up everywhere else because they would make nice props for your work. You know, if you give people more information, maybe those ads are properly targeted, but I didn't really allow you to see that, at least not intentionally.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Well,
okay.
Hey, Canon, let us know how this goes.
Yeah, good luck with that, Canon.
My verdict is, hey, go ahead and skip this one.
Yeah, I agree. Now, the next story is interesting because we've talked about this this before, at least this company before, on a previous episode that you were on. Meyer Optic, of course, the company that owned Meyer Optic, NetSE, went bankrupt. And one of the people that they owed a lot of money to was OPC Optics. And they actually ended up buying the rights and possibly inventory. I'm not sure exactly what the details were for Meyer Optic. and maybe other brands and everything else. So OPC Optics, which is a German company, has decided to dig in and figure out everything that NetSE was doing, the good, the bad, the ugly, and they discovered something fairly interesting. Mm-hmm. So this is another Petapixel article titled Meyer Optik-Görlitz Admits the Nocturnus was a modified Chinese lens. And so the Nocturnus was a 50 millimeter f0.95 lens, which is a fairly attractive type of moniker. I mean, that's what the Leica Noctilux would be at a much higher price point. But it was shockingly similar to the Mitakon Zhongyi Speedmaster 50 millimeter f0.95. I mean, if you were to compare the optical formulas for these two lenses, they looked identical. And in fact, the first version of the Nocturnus lens, before they redesigned the outer barrel of the lens to make it look different, looked suspiciously identical. About the only difference between these two lenses was the numbers on the barrel were blue instead of red in terms of their color. And
right.
So, I mean, this was a long-term suspicion. They changed some of the, like they put a different aperture and they redesigned the lens barrel for the second version of this lens. But OPC Optics, they really wanted to come clean on this because this was a no-go for them. They would never have committed this kind of offense to claim that it was a German-made, high-end quality lens at a much, much higher price point. Because Meyer Optik was selling this thing for $3,000. The Speedmaster, the Mitakon Chinese version, $849.
Right.
So, I mean, that's offensive. What's your opinion?
Okay, but this is really man bites dog, right? This one? Because, you know, over the past X number of years, it's been a lot of stories about Chinese companies knocking off other companies' intellectual property.
True.
So I'm guessing that this Mitakon Zhongyi fella didn't develop this lens on his own.
I'm sure that it has been strongly influenced by other designs, probably breaching patents or trademarks in some way, shape, or form.
So this does strike me as somebody ripping off somebody who ripped somebody off. Now, I don't know this for sure, and I don't want to cast aspersions.
Yeah, I should say that too. Like, we can assume based on all of the stuff that I see for sale on like Alibaba that and what's that clothing company, that Chinese conglomerate that has websites like Rose Gal and what have you that just rip everything off, copyright and patent adherence, I guess would be a good word. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say it doesn't exist, but if there was a lawless place, I'd say China, Asia, you look at Indonesia, Russia. It's
this
kind
is
of
the reputation they have. Now again, to just say, a blanket statement saying that's all that's happening, that's not reasonable. However, that has been historically, that's kind of what's been going on. How else can a company like Yongnuo all of a sudden make the exact version of the Canon flashes for one quarter of the price?
Well, that being said, Yongnuo is available through large U.S. retailers like B&H Photo. And
yes.
So I'm sure that Canon would have been able to put an injunction in place, or any of the more expensive flash manufacturers, if they found patent violations, to prevent them from being sold directly in North American retailers. So that being said, it might mean that they are playing the game somewhat properly, but still, they're cutting costs somehow. And so mm-hmm. their designs are derivative at best.
Yes, without having to put the R&D money into developing new technology, you can produce things at a much lower price point. Now, of course, Meyer Optik-Görlitz should have seen this and maybe added, another $50 to this. But even then, to then claim it was made in Germany, that's dirty pool.
It is. It is. But, I think that this has some value coming to light now officially, not just allegations, because OPC Optics wants this brand to have value. And mm-hmm. that value has been sullied by its previous owners in many ways, and we've talked about them in the past. So do you think they could make this brand, the Meyer Optic brand, have any value again?
Well, are they marketing it as Meyer Optic, or are they going to go with the OPC Optics? Is that the new name?
I think from what I can gather that they are going to try and use the Meyer Optic name again. OPC Optics has done a lot of industrial business-to-business stuff, and so they've been around for a long time doing that, but they've never done, to my knowledge, business-to-consumer enterprises, and so they'll need a brand to do that, and their existing one has no value within that space. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Meyer Optic, I guess the final question is, does it have such a negative reputation that it can never be positive again, or will it have enough of an existing reputation and a namespace out there in our heads and in internet searches to be able to springboard a new successful relaunch so long as they can address all the skeletons in the closet and point them all out and say, hey, we're not going to do anything like that again. That was somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that under new management sign on a seedy restaurant, right? It's
right.
Like, really, is it going to make me go back in there again? I don't know.
Well, that's hard to say. What is the path forward? I mean, if forget reputation, how are you going to keep them on the farm once they've seen the Metacon Zhongyi?
Well, I mean, this is true.
If that is a decent lens at less than one third the price, what is a $3,000 price tag going to do?
Well, okay, so this one particular lens, the Nocturnus, probably not going to be manufactured again,
right?
In any form. But if you were to I own the Trioplan 100. It's known for its wonderful soap bubble bokeh and its tack sharp stop down. I paid a stupid amount of money for that lens because there wasn't anything really exactly like that in terms of uniqueness on the market. In fact, I was just shooting some. I've got the GH5S in studio right now for some of the work that I was telling you about. But I decided to flip it into high-speed shooting mode, so I was recording at 240 frames per second of snowflakes falling with that Trioplan 100 lens wide open. So when the snowflakes come perfectly into focus, they're little sparkling white dots, but when they fade out of focus, they turn into like a ring. It's kind of like a fairy tale kind of effect. It's really kind of neat. That effect is almost impossible to do in post. You have to have the appropriate optics to do that. And if you can create optics that are unique, that offer something that no other manufacturer is offering, then that's a selling point for you.
Okay, so the question becomes, did they come forward on their own, really? I know what the article says. Or was this damage control once they were found out?
I don't think... Well, you know, they might have bought the assets of Meyer Optic without knowing this. And then when they were kind of doing inventory and research into how they developed their products, they discovered it then and realized they had to make this right. Because if they didn't, then it's on them to keep it buried for the future. And that could come back and bite them at any point.
Mm-hmm. So if they discovered this and came forward, then I see a path forward. They probably will have everyone's trust, even more so than before. And it'll definitely be a win for them.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I enjoy the one lens of theirs that I own. And I'm going to keep my finger on the pulse of this because those unique manual lenses, they have a certain flair. I mean, I do a lot of video macro photography work. I don't need autofocus and I'm not deterred by a manual aperture. In fact, I kind of like a nice tactile feel for some of these. I don't want to say antique lenses, but more classic designs, so long as they serve a purpose that something more modern cannot do.
Okay. Now, where are they located? No, you said Germany, but...
Yes. Bad Kreuznach, Germany.
Yeah, Bad Kreuznach. I'm not sure how far away that is, so I'm not going to pop in on go find out, so...
Okay. You pronounced it far better than I did, by the way.
As far as we know.
As far as we know.
You don't know.
You're right. It sounded more German.
Looks like it's up by past Frankfurt.
Okay, well, possibly. That's not close to you at all. And yeah, you're in Tübingen, right?
I don't like to give out that information.
Okay.
No, I do. I absolutely
confirm or deny.
No, I definitely people do know.
You mention it at the beginning of your podcast every single time.
And I do play for the Tübingen Hawks, so baseball team. So that it's out there. You can find it.
Exactly. And we should mention too, the Tube Hosers Photo Show. That is your podcast, right, Alan?
That is. Mine and Adam's.
Adam Schwartz, based in Vancouver, British Columbia, and so you were very close geographically to him before you moved out to Germany, and so you started your podcast basically to teach him how to do photography and let everybody kind of lean in on the conversation, and now you guys just basically banter back and forth about life and occasionally photography as the podcast continues.
Oh, there's always photo topics involved.
Exactly. But it's fun to listen to. I was listening to you. You mentioned me in a recent episode, and I was building a shelving unit in my studio while I was listening. So you kept me company there.
It's weird to get mentioned, isn't it?
It is, especially when I'm not expecting it. I'm just listening to see what you guys are talking about, and then you start talking about me. I'm like, wow, it's awkward.
It is. It's bizarre. It's happened to me on other podcasts, and I'll be doing something, like I said, living here in Germany, and one of the people I work for quite often and drop his name like all the time is a guy named Adam Carolla, and so he's told stories on the show while I'm here in Germany putting together a shelving unit, for example, and he'll tell a story that I was present for and then mention me by name, and it's always bizarre because of the Germany connection. Like, that's the weird part. Right. He's in Los Angeles, and you know, you being in parts undisclosed in Ontario, and that's the part of the technology that can blow my mind. But you are on this week's show, so if you're listening to this, Monday, March 11th, Dawn is on our show, so check that out.
So go and take a listen to the Two Hosers Photo Show. It's a great program. I've been on it, I don't know, maybe a half dozen times or so over the years. And,
more than that, I think.
I like when you bring me back once in a while. It's fun. And before we get to our final story, I do want to plug one thing that I'm up to. I don't usually plug my own stuff on the show, aside from mentioning my website, but I've got a bunch of photographic workshops coming up in 2019. Some of them have already filled up, but there are dates still available for... I've got a full-day macro photography workshop and sort of a half-day water droplet refraction workshop. Those are done here in my studio and in our award-winning perennial gardens. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff and you want to learn from me directly and see all of the weird and wonderful photographic equipment that I use, and you can use too, I'm more than happy to loan that out. I've got those workshops coming up. I think the full day one is August 17th, and the water droplet one there's multiple dates for. And the big one is in October. I'm leading a photographic workshop to Iceland. It's in the second half of October, where it'll be a little bit cooler, but far fewer tourists because it's kind of the off season there, and longer nights, which I hope will lean into some beautiful auroras that we'll have some fun. And it's tailored not to be the most convenient and easily accessible locations, but to be some of the most photographically beautiful locations across Iceland. So if you want to go on a photographer's dream tour to Iceland, take along with me. I'll show you how everything's done out there, and teach you how to do proper astrophotography and auroras and landscapes and waterfalls and all of these wonderful things that we'll be encountering. So that is something to look forward to. I know that we have some registrations and some spots still available. I'd love to get that one filled up too.
In general, when it comes to photo workshops, be they right at home in your hometown or travel ones, if you think that you're better off just watching YouTube and picking up as much information there as you would with a workshop, let me correct that. You are way off. Going to workshops is an invaluable experience. Whatever Dawn is charging, and I haven't seen yet, I guarantee you you're ripping Dawn off. The experience is fantastic. I've been to a few of them. I've been to Chris Marquardt's workshops here in Germany, and the experience is amazing. Not just the one-on-one that you get in your case, the one-on-one instruction from Dawn, but the interaction with the other participants is invaluable. So I highly recommend them.
Yeah, and there's a certain sense of camaraderie and community energy. But when you're in the dark fumbling around with your camera trying to get infinity focus, and what are you going to do? Start watching YouTube videos then to figure that out? No, mm-hmm. you tap me on the shoulder, or I'll be jumping around to everybody, because on these workshops, I'm not taking pictures until I'm certain that everybody else has gotten all of the shots that they want. And then right. I might be setting up my camera to do a time-lapse thing off in the corner or something. But I'm not there to take pictures. I'm there to teach. And,
yeah. And plus, Don will give all your personal information directly to Canon, so you can skip the raise thing.
Exactly. You know, I'm a multifaceted service here. But it's funny because I did take a workshop with Chris Marquardt as well back in 2010 when he came to Toronto. And one of the images that I had taken from a rooftop on that workshop, I have made more from that image than the workshop cost me. So there's that. You know, that was a profitable endeavor, not just for the education and the experience.
I'll let Chris know. I think you might owe him a couple bucks.
Yeah, maybe there's some royalties to be owed on that. All right, let's get to the final story, which is kind of a fun one. I found it everywhere. It's a YouTube video from a guy. How to Make Everything is his YouTube channel. And the title is Popular YouTube Channel Creates Camera Lens from, quote-unquote, scratch using sand and rocks. And I know, Alan, you were just out skiing and you didn't have time to watch the entire video, but you did do some Cole's Notes research onto this one. What is your elevator pitch opinion on what's been going on there?
Oh, okay. So very cool. This does look cool. I haven't had a chance to check out this guy's channel, which I will do, because I would like to know how to make everything. It seems like you'd come in handy. However, this is the guy who climbed Mount Everest by himself. I mean, sure, the Sherpa carried his oxygen for him, but he did it by himself.
Well, so when you say from scratch, yes, he did
3D printer.
He did extract copper from rocks, right? Yes. He did make glass from sand. But I mean, your propane torch, that's not exactly. Did you make that too? Did you go and refine your own propane? Did you make your own CNC machine? Because he used a lot of extra stuff in here. He did prove that some of it could be done without that, but that it was exceedingly difficult to do. So he took some shortcuts. One of the pieces of metal that he made, he had made by pouring, the molten copper and making that, but he had to do it in two pours, so it was two separate pieces that he then had to stick together. I mean, that's fine. Melt it back down and do it in one pour. I mean,
well, this guy's more MacGyver than I am. For me, the 3D printer was the kind of the kick in the pants, because I thought, well, you know, that's a little bit, that's too much.
And then when he had trouble making the other pieces form properly, he got in contact with a fan or a friend of his and sort of CNC milled the other metal pieces. You know what, if you can make one piece, just put the extra little bit of effort in to make them all. I do love the fact that he showed all of his failures. The fact that things did not go according to plan, glass shattering and things like that. So that I really appreciated seeing, that I was not aware of the process of letting glass cool. If you just let glass cool on its own, it cracks under the stress of it cooling too quickly, and all of the little bits and pieces that go into to making this happen. So I thought it was kind of a fun experiment. I don't know if I would ever make my own lens. I think that would be maybe a fun retirement hobby to try and to put something like that together.
Would it?
Yeah, I'm second guessing it already, but. but I love the experiential kind of the tactile, say, hey, you know what, I made this just for the fun of it. But I do remember talking to Tim Jennison, who he is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and inventor, but more importantly to me, he was the man behind a documentary film called Tim's Vermeer. Alan, have you seen Tim's Vermeer?
I have seen that, yeah. Excellent.
Excellent. And if anybody wants to see how optics and mirrors redefined the art world during the 1600s or so, when Johannes Vermeer, the famous Dutch painter, was active, then watch that. It's really fun. It's photography and optics long before photography ever existed. But I remember talking to him, and he said that, you know, it wasn't really that difficult for him to grind his own lenses, because he wanted to be, you know, he wanted to try and recreate the exact experience from that time. Like, what mm-hmm. could you do with everything of that vintage, recreating all of the pigments with what would have been available at that time, etc. And so he actually, and I don't really want to advertise this too much, but because I feel guilty, is I expressed so much interest in recreating that process that he sent me a copy of his comparator mirror and optics that he used in the documentary film so that I can experiment and try to recreate the process myself. It's been sitting in my closet for a few years because I just haven't had the time to set aside a separate workspace that would just sit undisturbed to paint one of my photographs photorealistically. But I think I should get to that this year. I think I should put that on my, it's too late for New Year's resolutions, but I'll make one now anyhow. I need to make that project actually happen with a time-lapse camera set up to record the entire thing.
Sure. And so what are you going to paint a snowflake? What are you going to do?
Oh, that'd be far too complex. I think I might start with something simple like my maple leaf flag photograph. You know, it's basically, you know, one color and white, and then see how successful I am there, and then take it a step forward to something a little bit more complicated.
Self-portrait.
Don't know if I do that. No, that seems a little bit too narcissistic for me.
Yeah, the whole process is really impressive. So if you have no idea what we're talking about, definitely check out. Even if you know exactly what we're talking about and haven't seen the movie, I highly recommend it. And I don't recommend too many movies because they're not very good anymore. But this was a great one.
A documentary. I mean, and if you don't care about Tim Jennison, but you love Penn and Teller. Penn and Teller directed this thing, and Penn Jillette narrates it. So, yeah, definitely
right.
One to pay attention to.
And that was the fat Penn and Teller, but now he's lost like 150 pounds or something.
Oh yeah, he's looking good now. He's got their show, Penn and Teller Fool Us, which I also recommend. But let's not go too far aside.
But this is a documentary that's an actual documentary. It documents a process while it's happening. They didn't look back on something and talk about something that already happened. I love documentaries that follow something along. Even though you kind of have an idea of where this is going to go, success or not, it really is fantastic. Definitely check it out.
Yep, perfect. All right, other things to check out, Alan, our picks of the week as we get into that. You sent me a link cryptically saying it's related to your pick from IKEA. So why don't you start with that?
Well... The short version of the story, we'll see, is when my wife and I and kids moved into our house 4 years ago, I think. In Germany, you bring everything. Even in places that you rent, you have to bring all the lights, the mirrors, the magic with you. Oh yeah, the lights. That's I see the look on your face. That's the weird part is you go into a place that you're renting. And it is bare. There's wires sticking out of the walls, and so you got to go and bring. Yeah, you got to light your own place, and which means when you move out, if you're moving, you know, you take that all with you, which seems completely silly. Here we are, and so we move into the place in 4 years ago into the house, and of course there's no fixtures, and so we need a dining room light, and. They're pretty fancy here in Germany, and I would describe the German design as being a little too German for me.
Okay.
Which is reasonable, but I'm not in love with it. So the long story short, which is too late at this point, is we could never find anything that we liked for a dining room light. Like, there was something very specific that I wanted, could not find it, so we needed something. And rather than just have a bare bulb hanging there, at a trip to IKEA, we spent, at the time, I think it was about 17 euros on your basic light reflector. Just to hang, it was just that basic thing that you'd see in the detective movies in interrogation scenes. And that was what was our light for a number of years. And it looked awful.
The one that I'm seeing on the IKEA website here is like a pale turquoise, looks like 1970s style kitchen appliance.
Okay, ours is white, so okay. I'm not sure what color. I thought I sent you the white version, but we bought a simple white, so it wasn't terrible, but it did look like from the 1970s, and that's all. It was $17. We could throw it up there. It was a temporary solution, which became, you know, a 4-year permanent thing. And so finally, like a month or month and a half ago, I went and made the decision. I'm buying the new lighting setup for the dining room, and I did. I found something I liked. My wife was away, and so for her, she came back from a weekend away and found this new light already installed, because that's how I do it. And so now I had this IKEA reflector. I think it says, what does it say, 30-inch on there? Something like that? No, it less than that.
15-inch, but 15 you might have inch. Had a different size.
That was about what it was, because I think it was around 40 centimeters or something like that, 30, whatever it is. So I had this sitting there, and I thought, you know what I've always wanted? Is I wanted my own beauty dish.
Oh, I see where you're going here.
And so it was one of those things. I'd heard the do-it-yourself projects on there, online. You could buy this and do this, and I never got around to it. I didn't want to buy a beauty dish. I have an umbrella, which I love. I have a softbox, which I love. But a beauty dish was just that something special. So this thing's kicking around, and I said, that's it. I'm making a beauty dish out of that. Took the Dremel tool out, the little the spinning cutter, and yep. cut the piece out in the back so my strobe could fit in. Any one of my 8 Nikon SB series flashes could fit right in there. And now I need a reflector inside reflector. So basically, the light comes in, hits that, bounces back, and comes out of the beauty dish.
So how'd you put that all together then?
I went to the hardware store, picked up, I think, 3 bolts, nuts and bolts combo. It cost me like under a euro. And scoured up and down all the aisles of the massive Home Depot type hardware store. Not called Home Depot here, but it's the same thing. Could not find anything that, like, I was thinking like a pie tin or something I could paint white that could be that reflector. Couldn't find anything. Remembered I had an old can of white paint at home. The paint lid was the perfect size. So I pried that off, scuffed it up with a little bit of sandpaper, actually painted it white, and for $0, it became the reflector. So
a
I now
paint
have
can lid. Wow, that's very MacGyverish of you.
Well, it's no do-it-yourself lens, but here we are. That's what inspired it. Is whenever you pick something, I know you pick something very geeky and very sometimes expensive. But I want to. This is something that you can do at home yourself, assuming you want to spend the $25.
Yeah, we should mention that the lamp on IKEA, at least on the American website, is $24.99. So right. For $24.99, a Dremel, and I'm sure you've got like an old can of paint kicking around somewhere that you should have thrown out years ago, but you didn't, because you might want to patch up that wall, and then you repainted it a different color, and you completely forgot that can of paint is still in your garage. So you've got everything you need.
You do. Now, you do have to mount it somehow, and coincidentally, the mounting bracket for my softbox would fit pretty well on the back of this, so I basically just bolted that to it, which I can remove and swap back and forth. I'm rarely going to use the softbox and the beauty dish at the same time, but now I have it just sitting over there. Fun little modification. I mounted it, the bracket, onto a monopod, so it is perfectly portable to walk around, take portraits in town, which I'm going to do as soon as the weather turns better here. It's not huge, like a beauty dish can sometimes be very, very large. This one's a rather small one, so you get this mix of, it's not hard light, but it's not soft light. It's somewhere in between. This very controllable, very pleasant light. I love the thing, and I'm going to shoot with it all summer is my plan.
All right. Well, that's a great pick, especially with the DIY discussion that we've had towards the end of this episode. So thank you very much for that, Alan. We'll make sure that the link to that is in the show notes. It does say that you can't buy it online, but at least you can get the article number from the website and go into your local IKEA and find one for yourself.
I'll bet you it's at 50% of garage sales that exist.
Probably that too. All right, so my pick is, and I've picked a number of flashlights over the years, and I mean, I'm kind of geeky about, you know, nice, compact, but powerful lights, especially, you know, for macro photography. They tend to be very, very useful, especially if they're bright enough. And so this one kind of caught me by surprise because of its size and its power. It's the Nightcore Concept 1, or C1, series LED flashlight. It's tiny. It's like the little one that you might kind of clip to the brim of a hat as like a nightlight or what are they called? Headlamps. But it's 1,800 lumens. You know, it can easily fit in the pocket of your shirt. At 1,800 lumens, which I had previously, a gigantic, one of their tiny monster series flashlights that is, I don't know, like 10 times heavier, 10 times bigger at 1,800 lumens. So the fact that it was this small and that powerful intrigued me. So I bought one, and then I was initially disappointed because it wouldn't turn on and function properly when I put my batteries into it, because it requires a higher amperage battery. If you're going to buy this flashlight, it's $61.04. I don't know why an odd number like that on B&H right now. And then the batteries aren't much more expensive. They're like between, you know, $8 and $12. But you have to get one that has an 8-amp writing on it. And so, and of course, Nightcore makes some other manufacturers make them as well. So you put the right battery in this thing, these big honking, it's like 18650 batteries. And it is just phenomenal. It is as bright as they say it is. I compared it to my other 1800 lumen flashlight, and it's really rocking. Of course, it does drain the battery semi-fast. So, I mean, maybe have an extra battery handy. But if you want to be like illuminating like a forest at night with something that'll just fit in your pocket, this is the flashlight for you. Again, it's a great macro light source because you can easily use a little crab clamp and attach this to a tabletop tripod and have all the light that you would need for a macro stage. And if it's that bright, you can even use that as a light source outside if it's a if it's an overcast day and you want to add a nice little sparkle of direct light, you know, backlighting something in a small package that will easily fit into your camera bag for $61 plus the battery. This is a pretty good buy, I think.
This looks like some X-File stuff.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I don't know where the technology has come so fast, so small into something like this, but
I meant shooting the X-Files. This was a big big feature when they were shoot that show out in the woods of Vancouver. Actually, Mulder would always have some sort of a xenon flashlight that probably would last, you know, 30 seconds before it drained that car battery, but.
Yeah. So, hey, you know, if you want to go and set some of these up in the woods and backlight them X-File style on a foggy evening, you've got yourself a nice shot. And
so how much time do you get on one battery?
I haven't actually drained a full battery yet. It's getting close to the end from what I was using. And I'd say at its maximum brightness, I had it running for about a half an hour.
And that is all those rechargeable batteries? Well, it's hard to go wrong with that. Now, for the layman like myself, when it comes to lumen, I don't know what a lumen is. I understand what a lumen is, but physically, so let's say my Canon 580 EX2 on full power, how many lumens was that going to spit out?
I have no idea, because regular camera flashes are registered in guide numbers, not lumens. And so there are so many different, like, what is a candle power? Right, I mean that measurement is actually a little bit more meaningful because it's how much light is required by candlelight to read, I think, something like that, at a particular distance,
or to light a Stanley Kubrick movie.
Sure, yeah.
Barry Lyndon, hashtag Barry Lyndon.
It's a measurement of light output, and I don't actually know exactly what it's based on off the top of my head, but 1,800 of them is quite a bit. And, you know, these manufacturers probably just come up with numbers, just like the milliamp hours on a battery. I mean, how can you actually know if this one is 3,400 milliamp hours versus 3,450 milliamp hours? I mean, they can just make up a bigger number as a selling point, and you're never going to really be able to properly test it. But let's just say it is brighter than you would ever need for a flashlight that size.
Mm-hmm. How many stones does it weigh?
It weighs approximately 0.75 stones.
Ah, so $3. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
All right.
I appreciate you sharing this one because I have I would like to say fascination, but more like an obsession with, I like flashlights too much. I really do like a good flashlight.
You know, as far as fetishes, that's not the worst you could have.
No, I mean, I use them to light up dark places. It's nothing weird. I just happen to appreciate the design and basically the number of lumens, it turns out, of a good flashlight at a price like this. So they could. I'm going to check on the German delivery.
Yeah, well, and I like the fact that it's a single diode in the center, too, because that's useful if I'm trying to condense the light. Like when I'm shooting my freezing soap bubbles outside, I'm getting the last couple of opportunities in this year, I use a Fresnel lens just to refocus that light, because, you know, a flashlight is intending to have a beam spread out, so I focus that back down to a singular spot. And if I do that with a flashlight that has multiple LEDs in it, like Nightcore also has the Concept 2, which is much more expensive. It's $200, and it has four LEDs within it. But then if I recondense that, I get four spots, not just one.
Right.
So having that one spot is useful, especially if you're trying to modify the light in any way.
And fun fact, Don makes his own Fresnels at home.
I do not. I go to Princess Auto here, which sells them for about $5 or $10. Which, if you're not familiar, Princess Auto is a wonderful chain across Canada where they basically sell anything and everything for hardware, but dirt cheap. It's where I started buying my third hand tools before I ended up just buying 1,000 of them direct from China.
Okay.
Yeah. So there you go. That is my pick. Alan, we kind of discussed it earlier, but where can people find you online and your podcast?
Go check us out at twohosers.com. That's where you can find everything you need to know.
And alanattridge.com is where people can find you as well?
They can. It's not been updated in a while, which is nice because anytime you see a private photographer, like not private, but a guy who's not running a company who hasn't updated his website in a while, means he's busy working.
That's right. That's right. Or that's completely abandoned all prospects of business.
Yeah, that's highly likely as well. I'm going to say I'm somewhere in between.
Okay. So then you should be updating your website.
I'm going to do it right now with my new flashlight.
Well, you can find me at doncom.ca/workshops if you want to see the workshops that I mentioned earlier. There's a link on the top of the website. Of course, the link to that and everywhere you can find both of us is at photogeekweekly.com. Episode 59, you can find all of the links to everything we talked about here, and of course, share your opinions with us. We love to hear either comments or emails about the stories that we talk about, and even suggest some stories that we might be able to talk about on future episodes. I love when the listeners point me towards some story that I might not have otherwise seen. So thanks to everybody who's been listening this long. I appreciate your time. So let's get out and shoot.